Varakov looked out from the balcony again at the skeletons of the mastodons. Karamazov said he had slipped when Varakov asked him earlier that morning about the bruises on the right side of his face. And Natalia, Karamazov had said, was feeling ill and might not be in for several days. Varakov had dispatched Vladimir Karamazov to the southeast to aid Colonel Korsinsky in setting up the new military district. There was a tough resistance movement forming in the area, intelligence reports indicated. Ever since the business in Texas, Varakov had realized that Natalia had betrayed Karamazov somehow, and that Karamazov was not quite right in the head anymore, perhaps because of it. The aftermath of the debacle and the loss of Samuel Chambers had shown a ruthlessness in Karamazov that Varakov had always suspected, but never imagined in its full scope. He had executed several of his own men for allowing the escape. He had used his forces to kill every suspected member of the Texas militia, a bloodbath unlike any Varakov was aware of since the purges of the 30s under Stalin. A soldier's stock in trade was bloodletting, but there was a difference between warfare and murder. Karamazov was a murderer, pure and simple, and the thought of this made Varakov wonder all the more about Natalia. Had something happened?
Elena, cancel my appointments for this afternoon. Call up my car and driver. I have business to attend to. If something must be signed and you think it should be signed, then forge my name. Hurry!
Varakov trusted his secretary. That was part of being a human being, he had always thought, trusting those who deserved trust and distrusting those who would stab you in the back and smile over your still warm body. He distrusted Karamazov. He could feel his palms begin to sweat as he worried about Natalia, the beautiful Natalia, the superlative agent, the tough fighter, the gentle girl, his dead brother's only daughter. Varakov sat in the back seat of his staff car, a Lincoln Continental expropriated from a parking lot near what had been the United States Federal Building in downtown Chicago. There had been, he reflected, that one more urgent reason for sending Vladimir Karamazov to the southeast, more urgent, he felt, than the brigands and the resistance. After Texas, Karamazov had moved directly to Florida, working through Cuban liaisons to determine what the exact nature of the launches at Cape Canaveral from the Space Center there had been the night of the war. All the other missiles that the U.S. had launched, Varakov understood, had been accounted for. These launches were the only exceptions, and that worried Kremlin leadership. It worried Varakov because it hinted that somehow the Americans had prepared for the possibility of war, and despite the crushing losses, perhaps had some new weapon no one had dreamed of up in space now. He stared up at the gray Chicago sky through his backseat window, wondering. During the exchanges, each side's hunter-killer satellites had destroyed spy satellites of the other side. Nothing remained in orbit except the hunter-killers and the Soviet space platform, which was now useless, Varakov thought, since the Soviet Union had no time, money, or desire to explore the reaches of space. Surviving after the war would take all the efforts the people of the Soviet Union could muster. If the Americans had put some mysterious weapon system in orbit, there remained no way of detecting it. The Soviet manned platform was in a polar orbit, and all the Americans would have needed to do was place their vehicles in an orbit out of range of the platform, perhaps around the South Pole regions. He was not an astronomer or a missile scientist. He didn't know, nor could he guess. He thought that perhaps it was some doomsday device, placed in orbit to detonate after a specific period of time if some radio signal were not received to scrub the mission, some gigantic burst that would blow away the atmosphere, the final retribution for the Soviet attack. The thought unsettled him. He had survived much, always because he had willed himself to do so, but this he could not impose his will against. There had been a mysterious reference found in a loose-leaf notebook in an Air Force intelligence installation. The words, Eden Project, and the drawing of an upward vectoring rocket ship beside it. Nothing else. Varakov wondered if the words Eden Project and the mysterious multiple launchings from Cape Canaveral were related. This was Karamazov's prime and secret reason for being in the southeast. Intelligence also indicated that apparently one official of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, survived. An official with the level of responsibility that he might know what exactly had been launched that night. He was a chief public information officer for NASA, James R. Colfax. Varikov recalled the man had been an astronaut, then moved into administration with NASA after a heart condition had disqualified him for spaceflight. He had piloted one of the space shuttles the Americans had been so proud of. This Colfax, Varikov thought, he would know. He had been making a speaking tour, recruiting for NASA at the time of the war, and had a home somewhere in Georgia in the mountains. If he would be anywhere, he would be there, Varikov thought. People and animals were of little difference. A wounded animal goes to its burrow or nest or cave. A man whose world is destroyed goes to his home just the same. And according to intelligence files, the man Varikov knew had defeated Karamazov, John Rourke, had his home in Georgia as well. If Rourke had survived after the affair in Texas, he might be there by now. It was a blow to Karamazov's ego to have suffered defeat at the hands of an American, and perhaps the two men would cross each other's paths again. Varikov's driver pulled up to the white-painted brick house in the expensive suburb, the house where Karamazov and Natalia lived.
Comrade General.
Thank you, Sergei.
Varikov wrapped his great coat closed around him as he treaded down the driveway. He had not called. He had not taken a helicopter in order to call as little attention to this personal business as he could. He was cold. The weather in America was insane, he had decided. It had been hot 3 days earlier.
Natalia? You're home. I know that. Answer the door. It is in order.
Please. I am sick. I can see no one.
Let me in now.
No. I'm going upstairs. Please leave.
Damn it. Sergei, my briefcase. Give it to me now.
Immediately, Comrade General.
If you are near the door, stand away. Natalia.
Uncle.
Varikov saw his niece standing by a swinging door leading from the opposite end of the living room. He assumed into the kitchen. Women spent a great deal of time in kitchens, even when they weren't cooking. It was like a man and his office, Varikov thought. He stopped thinking when he saw her face. She wore heavy makeup, and she usually wore little or none. Despite the makeup, he could see the darkness of bruises. Looking down at the floor of the living room, he spotted the dark stain in the white carpet, then saw tiny red stains on the couch.
You and Vladimir, you fought. He beat you.
He told...
No, he told me nothing. Come here to me, child. Let me see what he has done to your body. Natalia, I changed your diapers when you were a baby. I bathed you once. I am part of your family. You should not fear me. I must see what has happened. Either remove your blouse so I may see your back, or I will have my chauffeur radio for two women to undress you. Six women if I need it. This must be done. Let me see your back.
Varikov watched Natalia's dark eyes, watched her long fingers move slowly to the buttons at her collar, then slip each of the pearl-looking buttons through the buttonholes. She left the cuffs of the blouse closed and let it drop off her shoulders, her arms limp at her sides.
Turn around.
General Varikov could see the trailing edge of red welts above the lace forming the upper portion of the slip that she wore under the blouse. The slip covered her abdomen and much of her back. That, too, she slipped off her shoulders. He took a step closer to her, removed his right glove, and undid the back of her bra. He saw her hands rise to her chest.
I need to see no more, child. He beat you with a belt. Is the rest of your body like this?
Yes.
What else did he do?
He tried to...
I know, Natalia. Why? It is none of my business, but why?
The man, Rourke, I cannot...
I am your uncle, not your commanding officer. Tell me.
I fell in love with Rourke, but nothing happened between us. He saved my life. I had to save him. It was my honor to do this.
You should remember the first duty of a soldier, Natalia. Child, duty is ranked before honor. And honor is often a luxury. But I respect honor. Tell me something.
What, Uncle?
Would you go back to Vladimir?
He only punished me as I deserve to be punished.
You are as naive as you are beautiful, Natalia. punishment is in the soul. The body is not punished. It is given pain. A man does not beat a woman to punish her. A man hits a woman, perhaps in anger, once, perhaps twice. Perhaps that is just. A man beats a woman not to punish her, but to expiate himself, child. He did not do this to you because of something in you, but because of something in him. And I was afraid you would say such foolishness, that you would return to him.
Rourke's Harley-Davidson lowrider glided down the highway, which was devoid of man and machine. Traveling on the road was dangerous, he knew, because the Russians might be patrolling it. The cold wind stung his face, the temperature having begun to change over the last few days. He shivered slightly inside the waist-length leather jacket. He eased over to the shoulder, years of driving habit still forcing him to automatically glance over his shoulder along the deserted road to work his signal flasher. He had seen the signs of a large vehicular force on some of the side roads since he had left the retreat at dawn that morning. Brigands, he suspected. He lit a cigar, the blue-yellow flame of his battered Zippo flickering in the wind. Rourke had told Paul Rubenstein he would be back within 4 days or less, but experience had taught Rourke to prepare for 3 times that period. The low Alpine Loco pack was strapped to the back of the Harley with food, medical supplies, clothing, all the necessities. 2 straps crossed his chest. On his left side hung the Musette bag with some of his spare ammo and a few packages of dehydrated fruit that he'd made himself with the Equiflow dehydrator he kept at the retreat. On the right hung the binoculars, the armored Bushnells. Beneath these, in a Ranger leather camouflage holster similar to the one he used for the Python, was his Colt Government MK4 Series 70 45, metallified with the Colt Medallion Packmeyer grips and the Detonix competition recoil system installed. The twin Detonix stainless pistols hung in the double Alessi rig under his arms. The gun belt around his waist carried spare Colt magazines for the government issue, and these also doubled with the Detonix pistols. From the left side of the belt hung a bayonet for the M16. It fit the CAR-15 slung across Rourke's back, muzzle down, muzzle cap off, 30-round magazine inserted. He squinted against the sun despite the aviator sunglasses he wore. There was an expressway exit ramp ahead, and he detected smoke, he thought, rising from the road near it. It took Rourke less than 3 minutes at 85 to reach the ramp and begin to slow for it, then turn up on the crossroad. He cut to the far side of the interstate highway toward the smoke. It was a gasoline station, burning, several abandoned cars in the lot.
Disgruntled customer.
He doubted there had been any gasoline in the underground tanks for weeks or any electrical power to pump it. Rourke slid the Colt CAR-15 on its sling from his back to under his right arm. His right fist locked on the pistol grip, his trigger finger along the edge of the guard, flicking the safety off. He saw something in a smashed and battered 4-door sedan near the flames of the burning gas station building. It was a partially decomposed, partially eaten human skeleton. He moved closer to it. The top of the skull was split wide in the back, a blow he guessed from a large, not-so-blunt instrument, maybe a jack handle. He wondered who the man had been. Rourke turned. 6 dogs, 2 of them slavering and foaming, all of them huge German shepherd size or larger, tongues hanging out, saliva dripping from their mouths. He'd encountered feral dogs before, and rabid dogs. These looked to be both. In a few days, the ones foaming at the mouth would be dead. The others would follow shortly. If he were even scratched by one of them, he would have perhaps a few days at most to find a rabies vaccine or die like them, mad. His jaw set, he licked his lower lip. He distrusted the light, fast, penetrating 223 solids on dogs. Even if he shot one of them, it could still come down on him, bite him, scratch him, knock him down so the others could swarm. He needed the 45. 6 dogs, only 6 rounds in each of the Detonix pistols, but there were 7 in the Colt. He always fed the chambered round from the magazine, leaving the magazine 1 round down so the round could be edged forward for more reliable feeding. 7 185-grain JHPs in the Colt, 6 dogs. He loosed his right-hand grip on the CAR-15 and snatched for the Colt on his hip, his thumb breaking the snap on the flap, the gun snaking up, his thumb wiping down the safety catch of the Colt. The nearest shepherd launched towards him, its mouth spraying foam. The second dog, he couldn't tell what kind other than big, was turning, starting to jump. The round nailed the animal in the chest and it dropped. The third dog took the rounds as it leaped toward him, then fell. He shot his fifth round into the fourth dog, dropping it. The last two weren't interested in him and kept up their retreat. Rourke dropped to his right knee. Rourke stood up. Rourke holstered the gun, having upped the safety, then looked back at the half-eaten skeleton in the car. He knew now what had half-eaten it.
Damn it.
Rourke remounted his cycle, then turned back to face the burning service station. The fire had probably been set. That meant brigands, and Rourke wanted an idea of their strength. When Rourke stopped once more, it was approximately 3 o'clock. His watch and the sunlight agreed. The wind was stronger and the temperature getting colder. He had left the highway, a two-lane road, and turned off onto dirt and followed this along toward a valley. Dropping to his belly, he stared into the valley now, his eyes tight against the binoculars, the objective lenses sweeping the town in the valley floor. There was one main street, and at its end, by the edge of the town, was a large, wide grave. For two people, he thought. In the town, standing around a long, abandoned pickup truck, were more than a dozen men and women, their vehicles parked at the opposite end of the street. An assortment of pickup trucks, several motorcycles of varying quality, and one badly damaged station wagon. More of the brigands waited by the vehicles. Rourke guessed there were 30 of them in the valley, all told. He would have to move into the dense tree cover along the side of the road to avoid detection. He was concerned they might have someone exploring the rim of the valley.
What in the hell is this world coming to?
Barakoff opened his eyes and looked out the window, startled. The area he recognized from his initial tour of the city was the portion of the city that had been all but destroyed in racial riots many years back in the 1960s. Now it seemed like a similar chaos was beginning to unfold around him.
What is it, Sergei?
Comrade General, I believe it's the Freedom Fighters, sir. They're staging an ambush.
Barakoff had already known the answer before he asked. Thousands upon thousands had survived the war by being far enough away from the neutron bombs. And now it was many of these same people who lived in basements and hidden bomb shelters, who carried guns, killed Russian soldiers, and threw crude gasoline bombs at Soviet vehicles. They called them, the nerve, Molotov cocktails.
Get us out of here now, Sergei. And you get 2 weeks leave in Moscow and a letter of introduction to a brothel kept by a woman I know.
Not necessary, but appreciated, Comrade General.
Sergei was the best driver he had, and he would get him out of there anyway if it could be done. Barakoff drew the pistol from his greatcoat pocket where he left it earlier. The general saw figures running, their shadows made larger than life by the flickering of the flames from a Soviet truck overturned and burning. He almost lost the gun outside the window as Sergei, his driver, wheeled the Lincoln around a corner and onto a highway feeder ramp.
They have forced us onto the wrong direction, Comrade General.
It does not matter, Sergei.
Get down!
With the pistol in his hands, Barakoff rose from his knees. He saw a figure fleeing across the walking bridge, raised his pistol, and lowered it without firing. Then Barakoff looked down to Sergei. The young man's face was halfway through the windshield, and one of the eyes was bulged out. It seemed that the head had almost exploded.
If all those fools so believe in you, God, why this?
It was 10 minutes before the last of the brigand vehicles disappeared in the distance. Then Rourke gave it another 5. Patience was something he knew he could never sacrifice. Keeping a tight grip on the CAR-15, its chamber loaded but its safety on, he had slipped down along the side of the valley, past pine trees, guiding around through bushes. Finally, reaching the end of the woods at the edge of the town in a low crouch, he swept the muzzle of the rifle from one side of the street to the other. Standing, he flicked the safety off and clenched his finger near the trigger. Spent cartridge casings littered the ground, and where there was dirt rather than paving, the cartridges were half buried. From the corrosion and the depth to which the cartridges were covered with dirt, he judged there had been a large-scale, prolonged gunfight there, but several weeks earlier. There were picked clean bones in the street, some of the skeletons still partially clad with rotting clothing, all with rips and tears. He stopped at one body, looking through the shredded shirt and the bare, bleached ribcage. There was a tarnished police badge on the ground. Rourke looked at the empty eye sockets in the skull. The skull was punctured by what Rourke judged as 45 ACP slugs. The man had apparently died doing his duty, trying to defend his town. There were more cartridge cases, some plastic shot shell cases, a rusted and bent out of shape magazine for some pistol he couldn't immediately identify. He arrived at the side of the large unmarked grave he had spotted from the distance. He wondered, debating whether to go back up to the bike and get his shovel. He started to turn toward the near side of the valley to climb back toward where he'd hidden the bike, but stopped. He spotted the grill of a pickup truck turning down the street into the town.
Shit.
Rourke ran with his lips drawn back from his teeth toward the closest edge of the valley. He half dove into the brush, dropping his head low. The brigands were returning, and he couldn't afford to be trapped in the valley. He started up the slope, moving in the opposite direction of his bike, knowing that he could circle to get it. As he reached the rim of the valley, he burst into an uphill run. He began circling wide along the rim of the valley toward the Harley. He took the bayonet from his belt, the bowie knife was in his pack, and scratched at the ground with the tip of the blade. It was a foil packet from some of the food similar to what he had left for Sarah, buried but partially uncovered. Some animal had probably scented it, begun to dig it out then, but had been frightened off. In the corner of the package was a black ink date stamp. He stamped all his food with the date of acquisition.
Sarah.
He moved along the ground on his hands and knees, searching for some further clue he hoped to find. More of the food packages and a footprint. He dropped back on his haunches, leaning against a tree trunk, and his face broadened with a smile. Rourke took off the sunglasses and stared at the footprint, faint but clear. With the tip of the bayonet blade, he deepened the lines of the footprint, a child's tennis shoe with the design in the center. He remembered when he'd been with Sarah and the children prior to leaving for Canada, a few days before the night of the war. Annie had proudly made him look at the soles of her new tennis shoes. There was a daisy, a raised yellow daisy, in the center of each sole. As he scratched the ground with the point of the bayonet, he drew out the design of a flower. A daisy.
Annie.
After the almost impossible wait for the departure of the brigands in the valley below, Rourke had finally heard them leave after an hour or so. Moving back down into the destroyed town, he surveyed the scene with his flashlight. He found the remains of several fires, branches to which he could tell horses had been tied. They had camped there, were traveling by horseback, and from the branch markings, he judged there were three or four horses. Tildy, Sarah's mare, and Sam, his own horse, and at least one, possibly two, other horses. He sat down on the ground. The Jenkins family had lived nearby, he remembered suddenly. They rode. Mr. Jenkins, Rourke couldn't remember his first name, had been in the Army or Marine Corps. Rourke couldn't remember which. A retired non-com, Rourke recalled. If Sarah and the children were with Jenkins and his wife, didn't they have a daughter? He couldn't remember. Rourke realized, too, that if this had been their camp, and he was sure it had, they were likely miles away. But on horseback, the mileage they could cover was nothing compared to what he could cover on the Harley. He could tell nothing of the direction in which they had gone, but he guessed the mountains. On a hunch, he decided to head north. If the mountains were thought safe, then logic would suggest that the deeper the mountains, the safer.
Tennessee.
With horses, they would be lucky to make 20 miles in a day, especially with the children. There would have to be other campsites, telltale leavings of food, footprints. He wondered if there would be more cartridge cases, forcing himself not to consider what could lie in the large grave at the edge of the town. In the almost complete darkness, Rourke had almost missed them. Six men, armed, wearing camouflage clothing, and moving in rapid dog trot across the clearing. Rourke started for the Detonix 45 under his left arm, the muzzle snaking forward to fire, his left hand free of the bike already reaching for the second of the two pistols under his right armpit.
Rourke! Is that you? Rourke! John Rourke!
Reed? Captain Reed?
Yes! John Rourke! God, what a sight for sore eyes, man.
Captain Reed.
Rourke, we got airdropped in here last night. I kept hoping somehow we'd bump into you, man. Bradley, get over there and keep a lookout. Michelson, same for you, but over there. Jackson, Cooley, Monroe, take up positions along the tree line, on that side about 20 or 30 yards apart. Alert is a long whistle, then too short. Move out! It's getting cold. You know, you missed that. No weather forecast, and the weather has been changing so much.
Yeah, I know.
So what are you doing here?
You haven't seen a dark-haired woman and two children. Maybe with another man and a woman and child, little girl, I think. Probably on horseback.
Nope. Nothing even close to that. Why?
My wife and children. I saw some sign of them back about 30 miles, but it's from several weeks ago.
But at least they're alive.
The question is to find them.
Hey, listen up, Rourke. I could use a guy like you, ex-CIA, weapons specialist. You're from around here. Could even give me the lay of the land.
I'm otherwise occupied.
Yeah, but it's important.
So's finding my wife and children, Reed.
I know that, but this is for the good of all of us.
I don't really give a damn about the good of all of us. Organized government screwed up things the first time, it'll screw things up again. I'm finding my wife and children, then I'll figure out what kind of game I'm playing.
Well, maybe I can help you if you help me.
Well, I'm listening.
All right, let me explain what we're doing.
I don't care what you're doing, Reed. No offense, but I don't give a damn.
Yeah, but I can help you find your woman and kids.
How?
We've got an intelligence network getting together. All sorts of places. Use couriers, low-frequency radio, lots of ways of keeping in touch. If I put out the word, that's dozens more pairs of eyes looking for them. How fast is one man gonna find it? Huh?
What do you want?
Some cooperation. Maybe an extra hand with a gun if it comes to that. You in?
Just how good is that organization of yours, Reed? I mean, good enough and big enough to find Sarah?
We won't know unless we try. This'll maybe cost you a few days, maybe save you weeks or months, maybe make the difference for you in finding them or not.
Oh, I'll find them. You just tell me what you're here for.
All right. We're here for two reasons. We want a lowdown on the Soviet posture in Georgia. Karamazov just got transferred in here on assignment. You should be interested in that.
Natalia.
What?
Nothing.
All right. But the main reason we're here, and probably Karamazov too, is we're looking for a guy. You might even know him. He has a place somewhere around here, vacation home. Name is Jim Colfax. He's an ex-astronaut, big shot in NASA public relations before the war.
Why does everybody want this guy?
Ever hear of something called the Eden Project when you were with the company?
Mm-mm, haven't heard of it.
Well, neither had anybody else. We were sifting through the ruins of the Houston Space Center, found a charred file folder, and inside, all we could make out was Eden Project. Nobody's left from NASA that we can find except Colfax. If he's still alive, that is, and he should be right here in Georgia.
Why? Just because he had a vacation home here?
And he was speaking at the university in Athens the night before the bombing. It was the last engagement on a speaking tour, and he had a few weeks off.
That's a hell of a way to spend a vacation.
Yeah, tell me about it.
So you want to find him to find out what the Eden Project was?
We think it was to do with some launches at Cape Canaveral, just before the place got a direct hit. And we think the Russians are interested in it too.
All right. I'll give you a description of my wife, my daughter, my son, the horses they were probably riding, and some information on the Jenkins couple they might have been with. You get it out as fast as you can. You got a radio?
Yeah, if I only use it a few minutes at a time so they can't peg us.
You want my help? Then you get the description out. Now. I'll write the details for you, and I'll listen while you send.
Rourke fished a zippered notebook from his backpack on the back of the Harley. He stopped. Was beautiful a valid description for Sarah? And how about Michael and Annie? Handsome for him, cute for her? He decided on something more exact in nature. Rubenstein had already eaten by the time Rourke returned, and nearly jumped out of his skin when he'd seen him walk in 3 days early and with news of an American intelligence team insertion in the area.
What do you think, Paul? The Eden Project, something to do with Cape Canaveral. What does that suggest?
Well, the Eden reference seems to mean some sort of beginning. Maybe beginning again?
Yeah.
So, Maybe it's some sort of manned flight that would have been too risky unless there wasn't anything to lose. A lot of people thought the world would just get flattened after a full nuclear exchange. Maybe it was some sort of space colonization effort or something.
Maybe just the opposite, a doomsday device. You gotta remember one thing, Paul. Intelligence operations names rarely have anything to do with the actual operation, just the opposite. So maybe a new beginning simply means a surprise ending.
You mean some kind of super bomb orbiting the Earth? And time to blow up soon?
Yeah, maybe not soon. Maybe not for 5 years or 10 years. Or maybe the next 5 minutes. And maybe it's nothing we thought of. I'm supposed to meet up with Reed again tomorrow. We'll see if he's on to anything by then.
Rourke, Reed, and 3 of the 5 army men had entered the city on foot, moving past the university and into the downtown area. Rourke's skin crawled. He was weaponless, not by choice, but necessity. To be caught with firearms or even a knife in the Soviet-occupied city would certainly mean discovery and most likely death. Rourke had decided on the course of action as the only means of contacting the resistance. There was a man he knew in Athens, and if there were a resistance forming, this man would be in it. Darren Ball, ex-Special Forces, ex-mercenary. Tough, hard, experienced, and as anti-communist as any man Rourke had ever met. Ball, before the war, had taken to running a bookstore specializing in militaria, weapons books, and related items. He had lost a leg in Rhodesia, which had effectively ended his military career. Rourke, wearing a beat-up straw cowboy hat and dark sunglasses, scanned the street. The sight of the Kalashnikov-armed Soviet troops strolling casually in the cold sunlight through an American city disgusted him. Twice, Reed had to restrain one of his men, Bradley, a young black sergeant, who was fiercely anti-Soviet. With Reed and the 3 soldiers all disguised as civilians, and like Rourke, weaponless, Rourke stopped on the corner.
I hope nobody stops us for papers or anything. Bradley, you come with Reed and me. You two, drift around. Act cool. The 3 of us will meet you back here in a bit. Try and assess the composition of the Russian units here. How many, what equipment. Go on, listen and learn. Go!
Rourke, Reed, and the headstrong Sergeant Bradley started toward where Rourke hoped to find Darren Ball, the Liberty Bookstore and BS Emporium. Almost brushing shoulders with a half-dozen Russian soldiers, Rourke, Reed, and Bradley reached the far corner and stopped. The bookstore windows were boarded over, and the wooden sign hanging over the storefront had been spray-painted black, lining out the name.
What do we do now, Rourke?
We keep our shirts on.
Rourke slowly walked around the corner. A knot of young people was standing there. Rourke guessed, in violation of some Russian rule against public assembly. Settling the straw cowboy hat low over his eyes, squinting in the sunlight despite the glasses he wore, Rourke moved toward them, the 2 military men behind him.
Any of you know what happened to the guy who used to run this place, the BS Emporium? Fellow named Darren Ball, missing a leg?
What, you want information? Go to hell.
Hey, Cliff, don't! If he's one of them, only...
Relax. I'm an old friend of Darren Ball's. What are you so afraid of? If I'm one of who?
Look, I didn't mean anything, mister. Neither did he.
I can take care of myself, bro.
The young man stepped forward, shrugging his friend's hand off his shoulder. Rourke stepped forward to face him, glancing from side to side on the street. Rourke smashed his right knee up, higher than for a groin shot, just smacking into the stomach on the soft part of the gut.
Anyone else? Now, tell me what you were talking about, bro. You think I'm spying for the Russians, huh?
I didn't say that!
I'm not going to tell you why I want to see Darren Ball. That would only get you in trouble. He and I were old friends, and if you dislike the Russians as much as you seem to fear them, then you should tell me, now. Do you know where he is?
I'm afraid. The Russians pay for informers. People have started informing on anyone, whether he's done something wrong or not. Then they take you in. Sometimes they let you go afterwards, and sometimes they kill you. My sister, they let her go. She didn't do anything. She hasn't opened her mouth to say a single word since then.
Hey! What is going on here?
It's them!
Now, quickly, where?
A tent down by the fire station, but you have to...
You! A cowboy hat!
Yeah?
You're supposed to say sir whenever you answer!
That's an improper form of address.
But what am I supposed to call you? Hey, I asked you a question. What am I supposed to call you, huh? How about, Wimp? That seems to fit you real good, boy.
What is this, Wimp?
Oh, geez. Well, it's kind of hard to explain. Here, boy, I'll show you.
Rourke started to reach into his breast pocket as if for the stub of a pencil sticking out there, then swung his right arm back in a broad arc, the knife edge of his hand smashing hard against the young Russian's windpipe. His left hand flashed out to the brown leather flap holster on the officer's belt. He shoved the already dead Russian back against his five men, Rourke's left hand on an automatic pistol, a Makarov PM 9mm. The bullet launched point blank into the face of a Russian sergeant standing immediately behind the dead officer. Rourke took off running in the opposite direction with Reed and Bradley. He started to run into the street, across it. Looking back, he saw that one more of the Russians went down. He could see Bradley, the black American intelligence sergeant, starting into the street, bent down beside the dead Russian. Then his hands came up, an AK-47 at his hip. Rourke ducked behind a painted-over mailbox. A Soviet soldier fell less than 15 feet from him. Rourke lunged toward the dead man into the street, away from the mailbox, rolling to the pavement. Fragments of tar and concrete kicked up in the air as his hands landed on the AK-47 the Russian soldier had dropped, his fingers searching out the safety on the Kalashnikov as he rolled. Suddenly, there were more than a dozen Soviet soldiers in the street, everywhere around him. He stopped in mid-roll, rising to one knee, his first burst catching the last of the original six Russians. On his feet, Rourke ran toward the far sidewalk, Bradley beside him.
You're a goddamn hothead, Bradley!
Rourke spotted Reed running after the youth back in the alleyway in the opposite direction of his and Bradley's movement. Rourke ducked into a gangway between two buildings, Bradley at his side. At the end of the gangway, there was a concrete fence blocking his way. Rourke stopped at the nearest wall and glanced behind him once. He spotted staggered rows of wooden-framed houses in the concrete, the sills large enough, Rourke hoped. He reached up, the AK-47 slung across his back diagonally, his right foot perched against the sill of the lowest window, then pushed himself up, bracing his foot against the center of the window where it opened. He clawed against the concrete to grasp the lowest portion of the next higher sill, his legs swinging free a moment, his hands tearing away from the rough wood under the weight of his body, then his right leg swinging up for a purchase. Rourke glanced below him. Bradley was spraying the far end of the gangway, the dozen or so Soviet soldiers temporarily stopped there. Looking up, Rourke could see the roofline. He pushed himself up, both feet angled against the windowsill, his hands flat against the building sides. Then he reached up, pushing up from the center of the window, his right hand grasping for the roofline edge.
Bradley! Come on, man! Follow me!
Rourke wheeled to his knees, pointing the muzzle of the AK-47 over the roofline.
Come on, Bradley!
Bradley tossed the now useless and empty AK on the gangway surface, then started for the first window. Bradley was reaching for the second window, then, shorter than Rourke, barely got his hands to the higher ledge and pulled himself up. Rourke fired another burst at the end of the gangway. Bradley was on the second window ledge, half up, reaching for the roofline. His fingers splayed against the wall, but a good 6 inches too short to touch it. Rourke dropped the AK, pulling his belt from the loops of his jeans, snaking it over the roofline. Bradley reached for it and grabbed it. Bradley's right hand was on the roofline. Then Rourke felt the tension on the belt slacken as Bradley's left hand reached up. Rourke snatching for it with his right, his fist locking around the black man's wrist.
Thanks a lot, man.
Come on, here!
Rourke tossed his half-full AK-47 over to Bradley, then turned to scan the roofline. There was another building beyond, the roof at approximately the same height.
Come on, Bradley. Just like on TV!
Rourke started in a dead run for the far edge of the roof. His body crashed down on the neighboring roof, going into a roll.
Catch the gun! I didn't think I was gonna make that!
Bradley's arms flew away from his sides, like a bird trying to fly, a look of fear on his face for a fleeting instant, then his eyes wide. He stumbled back, falling between the buildings. Rourke dropped to both knees, one round hammering into the face of the Russian who'd killed the black sergeant. Rourke got to his feet, backing away, knowing the Russians were coming up the fire escape. He scanned the roof he was on. There were no buildings near, no hope of escape, he thought.
That was the fire station. I hope Reed and Darren Paul made it.
Rourke edged toward the far side of the roof, spotting the street below him in panic, fire belching up from manhole covers and sewers. A truck was parked by the curb on the street side, a pickup with a camper top over it. Rourke took a few steps back from the roof edge to get up momentum. He slid off the vehicle's roof and rolled down into the street. He pulled himself to his feet. There was a single Russian staring toward the roof line above, and Rourke pointed the muzzle of the AK-47 toward him. Varikov's one abiding wish ever since assuming military command of the Army of Occupation had been, he thought, a simple and basic one. He would have preferred that Lake Michigan be facing west of the city so he could watch the sunset over it. He walked along the lake shore, watching the deep blue of the water, then looking beyond toward the city he commanded and wondering about the country that lay beyond it. He walked along stone ramparts, slick and slippery from the water, but he walked very carefully, watching the waves break below him. Finally, he sat, staring out at the darkening water, thinking. Karamazov had to die, yes. But Karamazov was the favored child of the KGB, and simply to walk up to him and shoot him in the face would not go well. To try to implicate him in some impropriety would perhaps bring about the downfall of Natalia as well. And Varikov realized if he attempted to arrange for something concerning Karamazov, and it were to fail, then matters would only be worse. It could come back at him and only diminish his power and his ability to protect Natalia from the madman and from her own warped sense of guilt. No, it had to be a death, pure and simple. And if he could manage a death in such a way as to make Karamazov appear the hero, the valiant, noble, but thoroughly dead Soviet officer, that would only serve to heighten Natalia's security and his own. He worried enough about the latter, only to be realistic. He realized he was an old man, and from Soviet political standards, he was almost as old as one could justifiably expect to become. A hero's death for Karamazov. The man in charge of the American Continental KGB would die a hero, yes. But as to how he could assure Karamazov's memory, Varikov felt at a loss. He needed, he realized, to somehow make certain one of the Americans would kill Karamazov. And Karamazov was very good, hard to kill, deadly and skillful and well protected. To kill Karamazov, he would need someone who could best him, someone who was even more deadly, more skillful. A smile flashed across his thick lips. The man who had, however unwittingly, started it all, the fight between Karamazov and Natalia.
Rourke.
Elena.
Comrade General.
Coffee.
Yes, Comrade General.
And requisition a new uniform skirt. That one is too long. Rourke, you've bested Karamazov once before. I hope you can do it again.
Rourke had ridden the Harley and his weapons in the railroad yard by the end of town. He edged through the area cautiously, through the tall grass and weeds, the reddish clay under his feet giving because of the dampness of the ground. He could see two of Reed's men left behind with the equipment. Rourke edged closer to the men, who turned, guns ready, but the muzzles were already lowering as Rourke came to meet them.
What the hell's going on in that town? 4th of July or war?
A little of both, I guess. Bradley's dead, shot by some Soviet trooper, but I got the guy. Reed and the others are okay. He made contact with the resistance, I'm almost certain. Now, we can wait a little while, but not too long. I don't want the Russians slamming up roadblocks and putting out more patrols and boxing us in. Jackson, go over there to my left, on the far side in the weeds, and wait. Keep that intersection as your field of fire.
Got it.
Cooley, you take up a position about 50 yards down there and spot the road. I'll keep an eye out here. And don't get overeager and shoot anything that moves. There's a lot of civilians out there, okay?
You got it, Rourke.
Rourke crouched in the grass, the CAR-15 across his lap, and as he watched beyond the tracks for some sign of Reed or the others, or for some sign of the Russian troops, he reviewed what had happened. Once the young Russian officer had come up to him, it meant an arrest, and if nothing else, a short period of detention. But more likely, Rourke thought, it meant his identification. He was certain that after he'd helped President Chambers break out from the KGB Texas stronghold, all KGB units had the Soviet equivalent of a rap sheet on him. A physical description at the least, and likely a photo of him, fished from old KGB files when he'd been on the CIA active list years before. And that kid, Rourke thought, Cliff's friend. There'd been a look of fear in his eyes, the same look he'd seen in the eyes of the people he and Bradley had run past when the Soviet troops had been pursuing them. The people in Athens, Rourke thought bitterly, probably the people in any occupied American city, needed something to show them the Soviets weren't invincible. Rourke smiled. He knew they weren't. Rourke dropped on the ground, the butt of the CAR-15 swinging up to his shoulder, the crosshairs of the three-power scope settling on something moving on the far side of the triple crossroads beyond the tracks. It was hard to see clearly because the road curved deeply and was partially out of view. He saw the movement again, wishing the Steyr-Mannlicher SSG were with him rather than at the retreat because of the double-set triggers, the tolerances in the barrel, and the action. You could make reliable hits with the SSG out to 1,000 yards and sometimes beyond. A smile crossed his lips. The semi-automatic version of Colonel Colt's little assault rifle would have to do. As he watched through the scope, he thought about the gun for a moment. There were more expensive assault-type sporters than the CAR-15, but for his use, none he truly liked better. Spare parts, spare magazines, ammunition, all were out there to be found, scrounged from a military rifle, whatever. And despite his comparatively vast experience with weapons, Rourke abhorred guns that were complicated to clean or maintain. Rourke relaxed as a figure emerged into view. It was Reed, and not far behind him, Rourke swept the scope along, there were two other men who had been with him. And behind them, Rourke settled the crosshairs on the awkwardly moving man, was a fourth figure. The figure turned. Rourke caught the face under the objective lens. Darren Ball, prosthetic leg and all. Rourke leaned back in the tall grass and stared skyward. He wondered, without verbalizing it, if Darren Ball and men like himself had been more a cause for the problems that had brought the war, more than a solution. Then he thought back to the scared kid in the alley. There was no reason for fear, no reason why it should be endured or allowed to grow. Ball, in his own way, as an anti-communist mercenary, had fought that fear. Rourke had fought it in the CIA by working against the ignorance to relieve the fear that made men in life or death situations do the wrong thing or hesitate to do anything at all.
John! Hell, man, I thought they'd gotten you.
Darren, have you heard anything about my wife, my kids?
Reed already asked me.
Well?
All I know is somebody told me as they passed by your place the end of the first day after the war. Saw a bunch of tire tracks and some hoof prints from maybe 4 or 5 horses. Fella wasn't sure on that. The house was burned down, but it was still hot. A couple of bodies, too. Some burned up, some not. 3, maybe 4 people, one of them a woman. Found a couple of guns burned up in the house. They yours?
No. All I had at the house was a shotgun and a .45. Sarah probably took those. At least I hope she did.
She doesn't know where that fancy Dan retreat of yours is, huh?
She could have, but we never got around to it.
Well, I'll put the word out to look for her and the kids. Now, what do you want in Athens, besides trouble?
Ask these guys. They got the big ideas. I'm just a native guide.
You want that Jim Colfax. Tonight's the best time to do your asking, and you guys can give us a hand.
Well, let's cut to the chase. Time's wasting.
I'll make it short, then. We got a raid planned tonight. A biggie. I can't go, but Rourke, if you go and bring some of these fellas along, well, I'll make certain the whole resistance network has the poop on Sarah and the kids, and on Colfax.
Where?
9 o'clock or so at the old drive-in down the highway. You know the place?
Yeah. Check your watch against mine.
Looks like I'm 10 minutes fast.
I'll go by your time. Oh, I forgot to say thanks for the fireworks. You bailed me out, Darren.
You cost us, John. Full dress tonight. There's gonna be a lot of killing. A lot of killing.